Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to discuss various food subjects this morning. We'll start with honey, then talk about the prospect of universal school meals. And one of the guests for that segment makes mead, which, of course, is made from honey. After open phones at 10, we'll learn about Bia Diagnostics that does food testing in its labs in Colchester. But let's start by speaking with someone who was destined to be an apiarist. He is Zach Sutterby, owner of Sutterby's Honey. And we'll get into the spelling of each name a little later. Zach, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Zach a question about beekeeping, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Zach, if I said that all Sutterby's does is sell honey, I think I'd be way off the mark. So give us an overview of all the things that people can get from Sutterby's.
Yeah, that's correct. So, you know, beekeeping is much more than just honey production, which is, a kind of a common misconception. I tell people, hey, I'm a beekeeper. What do? Sell honey? And it's much more than that. Honey is only produced certain times of the year, and then the rest of the year, we're maintaining the bees, keeping the hives alive, hopefully, and getting ready for the next stage of beekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those things that we do, specifically what I do is I'm a migratory commercial beekeeper. I'm pretty small compared to a lot of beekeepers across the U.S. There's people that run 20, 30, 40,000 colonies, and I range in between 1,000 and 1,500. So ultimately, I'm pretty small in that aspect. But some of the things that I do, the big one is pollination. California specifically, I forget exactly, but I think they take in between 2 and 3 million hives per year just to pollinate almond orchards. So people all across the U.S. are shipping bees to California for a 6-week period just to pollinate almonds. I don't know if you eat almonds or not.
I do. And now I feel even better about those bees.
you feel better about buying a $15 bag of almonds.
So, Zach, when did you start working with bees?
Well, I would say, my first introduction to bees, my father actually kept bees when I was real little. I remember riding, we borrowed my grandfather's truck, and I remember riding, I don't even know where we went, and picked up bees, and they were in the back of his truck in the cab. And I remember looking in the back, just watching the bees fly all around, wondering what we got ourselves into. But
right.
So that was kind of the introduction. We restarted keeping bees. I think I was in high school, and this is just a hobbyist level. And my dad actually developed an anaphylactic allergy. So he was gonna sell all the bees off, and I said, no, I want to do it. So I started really probably when I was 19 or 20. And that was just on a small scale, 4 or 5 hives.
When did it turn into the business of Sutterby's Honey?
Yeah. So, I think it was, it's kind of a dramatic story. I think it was 2015. I had been in the I was in the Vermont Air Guard, and I was kind of looking for other options to explore in life. I was working a full-time job, and I think I had a really good year with, you know, 10 hives, and I had, you know, a few hundred pounds of honey. And I think my brother suggested, you know, hey, why don't you go try to sell, you know, honey to the Elmore store. And so that's kind of how it started. I ended up selling honey to the store and then ran out of honey. And so I think that was 2015. And I ended up selling all the honey I had and realized, hey, I need more bees and more honey. And then, you know, then my imagination started taking off and I said, hey, I'm going to do this for a living. So that was 2015. And I'm trying to remember, I think I was sitting at work and I had 40 hives at that point, and I decided I was going to take them south for the winter. And I borrowed a trailer, and I think it was October. It was snowing. I got my dad, who has an anaphylactic allergy, to help load up the hives into a trailer. We were carting them out in one of those Red Ryder wagons.
Oh my!
And loading them onto a trailer, and in the middle of the night, left for Tennessee. Which is the first place I went south with the bees. So that's kind of how it started. It was one of the craziest things I've probably ever done. But
any fear of dealing with thousands of bees? I mean, you have 1,000 to 1,500 colonies. I don't even know how many bees that would be. And then the other question is, why is it that smoke kind of keeps them pacified?
Okay. Yeah, so I work with bees of various temperaments and various weather conditions every day, and it's really, I don't even think it's a thought in my head anymore. It just comes with the business that I'm gonna get stung. But no, the fear is, you know, fear ultimately is keeping the bees alive, and are we going to be able to keep the bees alive? Working with them gets me excited every day. Looking at a hive that's thriving, or, you know, doing something that, you know, I learn something new every day doing it. And so, you know, the fear is the honeybees are dying.
Yeah.
And trying to keep them alive. And then the question about smoke is, smoke blocks their pheromone. So when I get into a hive, essentially I'm ripping through their home. They're not always happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we use smoke to kind of, they send out an emergency signal. And the smoke just kind of blocks the pheromone and keeps them calm, keeps them from flying, and kind of calms them down.
All right. Now, I do want you to explain the differences in the spelling of your last name and the spelling of your company's name.
Yeah, so we can thank my brother for that one. I think he came up with it. But, yeah, so the spelling of my last name is S as in Sam, U, D as in David, D as in David, A, B as in boy, Y, and it's pronounced Sotheby. And then the spelling of the business name is the same spelling, except we add B-E-E on the end. So it's Sotheby and Sotheby's Honey.
Gotcha.
So, you know, somewhere along the line, you know, I was supposed to be a beekeeper, I guess.
That's right. You were destined. Now, what I'm about to ask should not get you in trouble with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but you do deal in something called nukes. So tell us what they are.
Yeah, I'm sure that somewhere along the line, you know, I've probably been researched by the FBI or something
yeah.
for how many emails I've wrote nukes because we sell nukes. But yeah, so nucleus colonies are five frame, basically starter hives that, you know, hobbyist beekeepers or commercial beekeepers, would purchase. It's, another avenue, in our production. We start. I do a couple different options. I make spring nukes, which we make down here in Florida, which is dividing. We divide essentially big hives into smaller hives into nukes, and we add either a queen cell or a queen into them, and thus making another hive. So that would be, you know, I could sell one to you because after this conversation, you're going to be into bees.
Indeed.
Or hobbyist, beekeepers. So we do, and it's also another way to grow. It's another way we make splits of hives and grow. So. Mm-hmm.
So nukes are okay in this instance, folks. Don't worry about it.
They are. I haven't had anyone knock on my door, but you know, I'm sure they. Oh, that guy. He's just doing bees.
Yeah, you were on a list once, but now you're safe. Let's take a call from Sandra, who's joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. Yes. I have a question, but first I wanted to mention this. Book our book club read is called The Music of Bees,
mm-hmm.
and I learned so much about bees. It was fiction, but it was so good. But in this particular book, they talked about the music that the bees make. Mm. Are you familiar with any of that? To the speaker,
Zach.
I mean, to the guest.
That'd be Zach.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. So the music that bees make, referred to typically as the bee dance, is kind of a way they communicate, and I guess it is the way they communicate. And the exact each bee has a different dance. Each hive has a different dance, and it can mean various things, but. Typically, what it refers to is how far I think they use the sun and the sunlight, mm-hmm. and how far they need to fly to get to a food source of one or another. So they have the music is a dance they do, and you can actually see it in the hives where they actually wiggle their bodies. And it's kind of neat to watch.
Sandra, have you been inspired to do some beekeeping because of the book?
No. But I did learn a lot. But I wanted to also ask, do the bees also make that music when they're stressed?
They also will do it when they're stressed, yes.
Wow. All right. Thank you so much for that call, Sandra. And I'll add that to our book list. Next Wednesday, we're doing a book show. The Music of Bees is one we'll recommend. Now, you're in Florida, so tell us what you do during the swing when you head south with your colonies of bees, Zach.
Yeah, so the process I'll kind of give you a brief year-round process.
Yeah.
Starting in the fall, late September into October, we gather all the hives up in Vermont, which are there for the summer, and we start putting them on tractor trailers, netting them, strapping them, and shipping them down to Florida. They'll be down here in Florida. I'll come down in the fall. I'll set them all up, make sure they're good to go for a couple weeks. And then I head home and take a little vacation. I end up back in Florida in January to start feeding the bees. There's no, and there's no nectar sources that time of the year, so we have to manipulate that and make a sugar syrup. And we start feeding them in essentially, January is spring, the start of spring here in Florida. And we start boosting the hives up that way. They'll then get shipped out to California. And like I said, they'll be out there for about 6 weeks. And then when they come back, it's kind of full bore, and we'll be splitting hives, and the orange blossom honey is going down here, so we'll be making orange honey, which I don't bring back to Vermont, but I sell it down here. Mm. And then in May we start shipping bees north to Vermont, and then it's just kind of a continuous cycle. It seems like I blink and we're shipping bees.
Yeah,
they're here in the summer. We make a lot of good Vermont honey, and then back to the South.
Now, Zach, I know bees are incredible, but I need a little help with the birds and the bees. The bees part. They fly around collecting nectar. They get pollen on their wings. They return to a hive or colony, and somehow we get beeswax and honey, which is a cool trick. But how does that take place?
Yeah, so the bees will fly out, which it's remarkable for people who don't know. Honeybees typically live about 6 weeks max. So most of these bees that are out foraging, collecting nectar, won't even enjoy the honey that they're making. One bee is responsible for about a 12th of a teaspoon of honey. And one colony can produce upwards of 300 pounds of honey per year.
Wow.
So it's kind of crazy when you think about it, but yeah, they fly out, they find a nectar source, typically, you know, large nectar sources. We have, our spring flow, we have dandelions and apples, everything's, blooming. And then we get into, clover and basswood. Basswood, the tree that they make really good honey off. And then we get into goldenrod and knotweed and things like that. But yeah, they fly out, they get the nectar, they bring it back to the hive. And they actually pull the moisture out. They suck the nectar in and spit it back out. So essentially honey is bee throw up, but,
thanks for that.
Yeah, but it's got antifungals in it and you're good. So, they'll once it gets to a certain moisture content, then they cap it with wax, and it's sealed and I've never tested the theory, but supposedly honey never goes bad. So kind of inside the hive, you have a queen, one queen per hive. You have a lot of worker bees and nurse bees. And then you have drones. Drones are the male bee. And those are your three types of bees. You got a worker bee, a drone, and a queen per hive.
Mm. Then how do you extract the honey without really upsetting those bees? Because you're copping off with their great handiwork. How do you do that?
Yeah, so each hive is set up so they're typically two deep Langstroth hives, and then you have supers on top of those. We go around with fume boards and put butyric acid onto the fume boards and stick the fume boards over the top of the boxes. And the bees do not like it, and neither do we. It doesn't smell very good. It drives the bees down into the main part of the hive, and then we're able to peel the supers off of the hives and take them away to a location, where we extract the honey where the bees can't get in, somewhere that's closed up. And we can do that without, you know, without getting too many bees into the area that we are, you know, working.
We've got about a minute and a half left, but I do want you to explain. I know you've got education packages for people. So explain what these are and what someone will learn during this time.
Yeah. You know, one of the big things of beekeeping is, you know, a lot of people sell bees and they don't educate people on how to successfully keep them, which is becoming more and more challenging. And a lot of people buy bees and then they die, and they buy bees and they die, and it gets expensive and people get frustrated. So one of the things that I'm trying to do, and I'm very busy, but I, you know, I'm trying to teach and educate people on how I do it, you know, and I'm showing people, you know, hey, this is what I do. This is how I keep bees, and this is how I keep them alive. So some of the things you're going to learn is just, you know, how I operate and how it's worked for me, and how I've become successful doing it. And I have, you know, different options and different levels, for people to choose from, one of which, you know, I can go out to their property and look at their hives and educate them on what I think or what my opinion is on what they should be doing.
And, as far as a very big question for a little bit out of time, overall, the health of bees right now, I know we've been very concerned about that.
Yeah. There's a bill that's in the House right now. I think it's H-626, and it's really important. There's a lot of neonicotinoids out there, and say that right, but that are, you know, are causing a lot of damage, not only bees, but other pollinators, birds, and, you know, gets into the water stream. So that's one of the big concerns is the spray and insecticides out there.
That's Zach Sutterby. He owns Sutterby's Honey in Mooresville. You can visit Sutterby's Honey, and that's with two E's at the end, sutterbyshoney.com. Zach, give our best to those wonderful pollinators and honey makers, and thanks for being on the show this morning.
Thanks, Rick.
Take care. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll return to discuss Universal School Meals. And coming up today at 1, 3 full hours of The Getaway with the G-Man, Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. The pandemic has been brutal and has tested every one of us in different ways. And through those challenges, we've also learned a lot about how we can help one another through even the most difficult circumstances. So what of those lessons can we incorporate into our standard way of doing things as our world returns to normal or close to it? One idea that is being discussed at the State House and around the state is universal school meals. Joining me to discuss the idea is Inor Horton, the executive director of Hunger Free Vermont. Inor, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. It's great to be back with you.
Good morning. Great to have you back. We also have Ricky Klein, co-owner of Grunfeld Meadery. Ricky, thank you for being here as well.
My absolute pleasure.
Great. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests about Universal School Meals, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Inor, just so people are aware of your organization, what is the mission of Hunger Free Vermont?
Hunger Free Vermont's mission is to end the injustice of hunger and malnutrition for all Vermonters.
And Ricky, tell us a little bit about Grunfeld Meadery.
We are a meadery, meaning we brew mead, which is an alcoholic beverage, and support a lot of different social missions through our work, as well as environmental missions.
Based in St. Albans, is that correct?
Correct.
And is there any translation for Grunfell?
There is. It's a nerdy play on words. It literally means Vermont, in Old Norse. Grun is green and fell is mountain.
Oh, well done. Got me on that one. I love it. Now, Anor, throughout the pandemic, what has the state been able to provide for students in terms of meals at school?
Right. Well, this has been one of the, very few bright spots of this pandemic.
Right.
Because of federal funding and waivers that Congress passed to the school meal programs at the start of the pandemic, all schools in Vermont that provide meals for students have been able to provide those meals universally. In other words, free of charge, breakfast and lunch to every single student, no application required, no questions asked, no income test, no cash register in the cafeteria. And that has been a real incredible benefit for students and families during this really difficult time.
And that's all grade levels, Anor?
That's right, all grade levels. Every kid enrolled in every school district in our state.
And then what happens in the summer months?
Well, again, during the pandemic, because the federal government waived the normal program rules, every community in Vermont has been able to provide free summer meals, up to two meals a day, for any child ages 0 to 18, and again, without application and without any income tests. And that has resulted in more than doubling the number of meals served to kids in Vermont during the summer, these past two summers. It's been an incredible help to families during what's often the worst time of the year for child hunger, because school's not in session and they don't have access to those school meals.
So what is the Universal School Meals campaign proposing?
Well, what the Universal School Meals campaign is calling for is for our state to enact permanent universal school meals in all Vermont public schools. So to continue what we've had during the pandemic and what we found has made such an incredible difference for kids and teachers and schools and families during this time. It's been needed for a long, long time. We know that many kids who need school meals can't afford them, don't qualify to get them for free, or are too ashamed to identify themselves as kids and families who need help. And so even if they're eligible for free school meals, they don't eat them.
Ricky, why is this program that you support, this idea of universal school meals?
So I grew up in an area with incredibly high income disparity within the district and within individual schools to such an extent that they had to put systems in place so that students on free and reduced lunches could enter a secret code to prevent the stigma associated that Anora was just talking about, that people may not even want to request them. And we built our schools, one of the few places left in our society where everyone has this focus on equal access for all. We try to get the best textbooks, proper lighting, proper heating, proper cooling. And it seems almost absurd at this point that the sine qua non of all of that is children who feel safe and secure. And food security is where that starts.
And explain what that stigma feels like. How to, when you experience that, when there isn't a secret code, when every one of your classmates know that you're getting a free or reduced lunch.
So in certain places, it was to such an extent that there was a line for kids with free and reduced lunch and a line for kids that were paying. And I was lucky to come from a family where we were able to afford the lunches at school or to send me with a bag lunch many days. But that is a piece of our society's history that I think we should leave behind us. This idea that schools are here to educate, and when you come to that school, your level of preparedness is being defined on your socioeconomic economic status or your family background, your family history with schooling, and creating that equitable peace has been the work of the last two centuries. And I can't really imagine what it is like to go to school, to be given those opportunities, especially for new Americans, and then to have this othering happen around, you know, lunch and food, something that historically has been the thing that brings people together.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Stuart joining us from Worcester. Hi, Stuart. Go right ahead.
Hi. You know, there's absolutely no question that there should be universal access to free lunch at schools. However, the Department of Education uses the count of folks that apply for free and reduced lunch as a measure to determine potential funding for schools that may have a high number of at-risk kids. That's one of the big arguments against moving forward with free lunches for all. Do you have a reply for the department or an alternative method for calculating need that the Department of Education can use?
Stuart, great question. Anora, would you like to answer Stuart's question?
Yeah, so Stuart is 100% correct. And I have to say that and this happens across the country, not just in Vermont, that we've gotten quite lazy and we've dumped all of the pressure of figuring out how to allocate education funding for all kinds of education supports for economically disadvantaged students on the school meal programs for decades. And it's time to stop that because, first of all, what that does is it dramatically undercounts the number of economically disadvantaged students in our schools. And every single school in our state that is not providing universal meals already, and every single school across the country is leaving federal education dollars that they should be getting to help with their educational programs on the table in Washington, D.C. by using the school meal applications. Because families don't have to fill them out, and many families don't because they're too ashamed to ask for that help, and it's too stigmatizing. And there is an alternative. It already exists, and it's already being used in the over 60 schools in Vermont who were already providing universal meals before the pandemic. It's an alternative income form. Our legislature, in a different bill, is looking at enacting a new version, simplified, very easy to use, of a universal income declaration form that all families could complete. It would be very simple. It would be a checkbox a list of the students in your household, and it's going to make it much more accurate and much easier for us to make sure that every student who's entitled to those educational supports receives them and that our schools get all the federal education funding that they're entitled to. So it's a very exciting time. We have the chance to solve a lot of problems at once right now by passing universal school meals.
Stuart, great question. Thanks for calling in. Anora, this is being addressed in Senate Bill 100. So specifically, what would the bill do?
Well, we are hoping that the House Education Committee that has the bill right now is going to pass it with full universal school meals. That's both breakfast and lunch included. Right now, the Senate sent the House a bill that's a universal breakfast only. Mm-hmm. So what we want is for S-100 to provide universal breakfast and lunch for all students in all Vermont public schools and to require that schools provide those meals. But the state education fund would cover the cost associated with providing those meals that isn't covered by federal school meal reimbursements. But in order for that to happen, schools would need to make sure that they were taking every step to maximize their ability to draw down those federal reimbursements to cover the cost of meals. Schools would work to enact best practices around making sure that all kids were really getting to access those meals and they were being able to draw down that federal money. So in a nutshell, that's what S-100 would do.
And, Anor, if it's approved for both breakfast and lunch, do you have an idea of the difference between federal funds and the total amount to be able to have universal meals, school meals, and so then how much it would cost the state of Vermont?
Yeah, I mean, we've been studying that question for the last 3 years, and we've looked at what's actually happened in Vermont schools that have been providing universal meals, because over 60 Vermont schools have been providing universal school meals, some of them for 8 years now. Mm. And so we really looked at how many students participate when you have universal meals and what those costs are. And, you know, no one knows exactly what would happen if we did this statewide and we weren't in a pandemic while we were doing it.
Right.
But our estimate is that it would cost between $15 and $25 million a year.
And Ricky Klein, how do you see this bill addressing the need for all students in Vermont performing at their best?
Well, there was a great study done many, many years ago where Cheerios tried to prove that they helped kids learn better, but they were working with a population that wasn't getting any breakfast at all. And one of the people analyzing the research joked that, well, we proved once again that children who are starving are not good at math. And while it is facetious and a blot on the history of science, or maybe a success, I don't think that there's anyone listening who has tried to do any amount of complex physical labor or mental labor and not felt that slow brain fog that comes from a drop in blood sugar or just inconsistent diet, even that alone. So the consistency of this piece is also, I think, a really important part of helping our students excel, or at least be able to use the other services from those textbooks to those teachers that we're already paying for.
Anor, you said the difference somewhere between $15 and $25 million. So where does that money come from? Everything, you know, has to be paid for. Where does Vermont come up with that amount of cash?
Right. Well, we are asking that school meals be funded through the education fund, the way that every other aspect of making sure that our kids are ready and able to learn in school is funded out of the ed funds, like school counselors and toilet paper and school bathrooms and paving the school parking lot. All of those things are paid for through the education fund. And meals is the only thing that isn't provided for all students through the education fund. So for us, it's a fundamental flaw in the setup of how we take care of our kids in schools that's existed for many, many, many years. It's a simple matter of equity, and it's what we need to do. And if you remember that we spend over $1.6 billion a year to make sure that our students are educated, to not feed them, I mean, as Ricky just said, to not make sure that every kid has the nutrition for their brains to develop, and the fuel to be able to focus and learn in class and make use of those math and literacy tutors and make use of all of the different educational supports that we're providing with that $1.6 billion. It seems a minuscule price to pay.
Ricky, why have you signed on in support of this as a business owner?
So I have obviously employees with children. I have children myself, so it is personally near and dear to my heart. But it really jumped out of the many, many wonderful things that you can support in the state of Vermont with my past experience that I was talking about, watching that lack of equity play out in so many different ways, social stigma being one of the ones that was most memorable to me as a child. It seemed like a no-brainer.
And, Anor, if Senate Bill 100 is passed, how does this even the playing field between school districts with greater means, those that are more cash-strapped?
That is such a great question, Rick. And the thing that's really interesting about the way that school meal funding works is that the students that suffer the most are actually our economically disadvantaged students in higher-income towns and higher-income school districts. So it's harder for higher income schools to be able to fund a universal meals program on their own. And so actually, S-100 is going to help small schools the most, rural schools the most, and schools with a higher number of higher income families, actually. And the problem there is that in Vermont, we have spread out poverty. We have many low-income students in every district, including high-income districts like mine. I live in Williston, Vermont. And I know firsthand from talking with our school administrators in our district how much they struggle because the stigma of turning in your school meal application, the stigma of getting in that free meal line in a higher income district is even worse for our economically disadvantaged students. So this is going to level the playing field in a big, big way.
Nora Horton is Executive Director of Hunger Free Vermont, and we've also been talking with Ricky Klein, co-owner of Grenfell Meadery in Colchester, and we've been discussing Senate Bill 100, which is universal school meals. If you'd like to learn more about it, you can visit universalschoolmealsvt.org. Nora, Ricky, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us this morning to talk about this.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, great. We're going to take a break for a top of the hour CBS News update, and then we're going to open the phones until 10:30. And a reminder that coming up this morning at 11 o'clock, it's Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah. That's followed by the governor's COVID-19 response news conference starting just after noon. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint, and okay, for the first time since last Thursday, we're going to open up the phones to hear what you're thinking. 802-244-1777 and 877-291-8255. A lot of food talk this morning. We can keep that going. Sugar makers, what have you been collecting and boiling? Good week last week. I think we've got some good flow out there. Anyone get out and enjoy the sugar on snow with the pickle, the donut, and I think you get milk or coffee at most places. Also, news about bird feeders. I'll let you know about that, which is food of another sort. And, of course, If you'd like to talk about the situation in Ukraine, I'm all ears. And I will provide some info on a local effort to raise money for the people of Ukraine and, of course, the vigil tonight on the State House lawn. But the phones are open, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, the email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And batting leadoff is the Duke of Newbury, the Duke without portfolio, Fred. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. Hey, you know, this war on Ukraine is very interesting because the United States military is studying this very carefully, and they're discovering that the Russian army isn't really a very good army.
Yeah.
I mean, Ukraine was nothing, and they're still battling them. And the Russians are using their same old trick. If you want to know how the Russians operate, all you have to do is read The Fall of Berlin by Anton Beevor. And the Russians are doing the same thing as they did to Berlin. And the kicker was, when they finally invaded Berlin, the Russians lost, killed over 100,000 soldiers. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And the Germans didn't lose that many soldiers. But the kicker is, it's just unbelievable. And the other thing is, why is war inevitable?
Yeah.
I mean, ever since Homo sapiens has been around, we've had war. It is quite simple. It's very simple why war is inevitable. And that's because resources make war. There was an interesting study on sedentary farming. When sedentary farming occurred, war became very popular for a good reason. The land became more valuable. Simple.
But is it the resources, Fred, or is it the greed?
No, it's the resources. Okay, resources and greed, they're one and the same, right?
They don't necessarily have to be, but unfortunately, I think humans have developed that way.
They are the same. Because look at the Rio Grande. The Rio Grande is the southern border. If the mother lode was discovered south of the Rio Grande by, say, 50 or 60 miles or 100 miles, guess where the Mexican border would be? Wouldn't be on the Rio Grande.
Point well taken. But, Fred, do we need borders? Is there, you know, if we were just one massive collective, all the resources.
You can't be one massive collective. No, no, you can't. Because we've got different languages. We've got different cultures. There's no way. We need borders. If you don't have borders, then you don't have a country. Simple. Not complicated. Why don't we have borders? Even the Indians had borders.
I'll take that point. But, you know, did we at any point, you know, when things started, why couldn't we all have been one collective?
You can't. If we lost World War II, we'd be speaking German on the East Coast, Japanese on the West Coast.
But I'm going back further in time of humans. You know, of Homo sapiens, you know, that we would have not developed what we have developed, religions and countries and languages that do seem to separate, unfortunately, rather than unite. But I take your points. I think you've made some of the most excellent points that you've had in the year and a half we've been talking. Go ahead, Fred.
When the Pilgrims came here,
mm-hmm.
What happened to the Indians? The Pilgrims wanted to leave because there was all kinds of wars over there and they were being persecuted. So the Pilgrims came here and they found this a very productive country. And then what happened? The Pilgrims and other people came here and we started moving west,
mm-hmm.
because there was valuable land to the west. There was resources to the west.
Yeah.
The poor Indians, well, they weren't as sophisticated as the Europeans, and the Indians lost.
Yeah, Native Americans.
Well,
and that. Yeah, thanks, Fred. Great call today. Really good stuff to think about. All right, I want to mention a couple things about Ukraine. Thanks for getting us started in that direction, Fred. And your point, your original point about the Russian army. You know, Russian production has always been something of, I don't want to say a joke, but less than what it should be. And, you know, you go back to the Army in World War II, you look at the production of the nuclear reactors at Chernobyl, and when you read about that and the poor quality of the materials that the Russians were producing. And we're seeing the same thing, you know, a lot of the equipment that was brought out in you know, to fight in Ukraine has just been less than average and has caused problems. And then, yes, a ragtag bunch of patriots fighting for their country has been able to hold off Russia in all of this. All right. A couple things I want to mention about Ukraine. First of all, people have asked questions about how they can support the people of Ukraine. And there is a GoFundMe page set up. You can go to GoFundMe.com and search Vermonters for Ukraine. They have set a $10,000 goal. It's organized by Sonia Spaulding, and it is to support Larissa Haas of Rise Up Bakery in Barrie, who we spoke to a couple weeks ago. And you can check that out again, Vermonters for Ukraine at GoFundMe.com. And then if you'd like to show your support tonight, there is a Freedom and Unity vigil that's being held for Ukraine on the State House lawn. It's 6:30. Governor Scott will be there, Lieutenant Governor Gray, Congressman Welch, Senate President Becca Ballant, House Speaker Jill Kerwinski. And this evening, Governor Scott will sign what is House Bill 717. And this is humanitarian assistance to the people of Ukraine. The total is $644,826. Seems like an odd number, or even though it's an even number, weird number to give. But here's what it, how they figured it out. There are, according to the last census, 643,077 Vermonters. So they're giving $1 for every Vermonter. And then $1,749 is added to that. That's from the sales of Russian-sourced products between February 24th and March 2nd. That's probably when we stopped selling it, by the Department of Liquor and Lottery. So that brings us to the $644,826 that's going to the people of Ukraine from us, the people of Vermont. All right, let's take another call. Karen's joining us from Hardwick. Good morning, Karen.
Hi. I'm just curious why we have billions of dollars to put an Iron Dome over Israel, but not over Ukraine.
That I can't answer. I'll have to do some more research on that. And that would be, when you say we, is that the U.S. government that is financing something there?
Yes, we send billions every year to Israel for their Iron Dome to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
But not to Ukraine.
Now, I know we send a certain amount of aid to Ukraine, you know, and I'm not exactly sure how much that is. I do know that the federal government has recently added something like $16 billion, I hope I'm not making that figure up, for humanitarian aid to Ukraine. That was just approved maybe last week. But
that's not going to stop the bombing, is it?
No, it's not. And your point being, this is a very important country that we know sits right there on the border of Russia. We know has come under heavy scrutiny, if not some already military actions before this by Russia into Ukraine, because Ukraine has been looking west and thinking about joining NATO. So why wouldn't we have bolstered the amount we support Ukraine with before this? Is that a fair estimation,
Karen?
Just
a question in my mind, yeah.
Yep.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yep, fair point. Great thing for us to all think about. Why wouldn't we have bolstered this very strategic country, which we're now watching being invaded by Russia. We're discussing food, birds, Ukraine. Also, a reminder that Thursday, next stop on the WDEV 90th anniversary tour, I'll be at the Hastings store in West Danville, there at Joe's Pond. I have a great lineup of guests, and of course, we'll be discussing Joe's Pond's ice out strategy. See if we can maybe figure out exactly when the ice might break through. Next Wednesday at 9, we'll have our next book show. So tune in for that. And we've got the phones open right now to join in, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. We had a call from John in Duxbury, and unfortunately it dropped, and he was going to provide us with an update on the Vermonters for Ukraine GoFundMe site. Now, I had said that they had set a goal originally of $10,000. So far, raised $14,380. And Sonia Spalding organized this. And I should read more. I said it was for Larissa Hawes, but let me read what Sonia did write about what the money is being raised for. It says, Larissa Hawes is from Ukraine, lives in Barrie, runs a bakery with her husband, Jim. Her heart is breaking with the news of what is happening to her home country. She's trying to raise money to send essentials like hygiene products, clothes, food, first aid, medications to Ukraine. And this is a way of helping to do that. So Vermonters for Ukraine at GoFundMe.com, and they have already raised over $14,000. Way to go, Vermont. Way to step up. All right, on to Marshfield next. Let's speak with Lawrence. Good morning, Lawrence.
Good morning, Rick. Wanted to talk about bees.
Yes.
I was a home beekeeper for 14 years until a few years ago, but loved them. They were great. And there are a couple things. I think you, in your question, you said something about the bees bringing pollen in on their wings.
I did.
You said that.
Yeah, I did.
It's not on their wings. It's they have three pairs of legs, and the last set of the back legs have what they call pollen sacs. They're not really sacs. They're more, they look like sacs when they're full of pollen, but it's basically, my understanding is, thick, heavy hairs, sticky hairs on the back. And it, when they go in and get the nectar, they're rubbing against the pollen and they collect it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell what kind of honey you're getting by the color of the pollen.
Ah, gotcha.
Certain flowers, so that's cool. Another thing with the smoke, my understanding is that when you smoke a hive, the bees, they think that their home is burning down, so they go down below into where to the hive box, and they gorge themselves with honey because they're thinking that they're going to have to find a new place.
Oh, interesting.
Food. And so I guess the process of eating, gorging the honey, and also I think it calms them down, too, mm-hmm. is what I hear, so that they're less likely to get upset when you're getting into their hive.
Right. And, Lawrence, let's go back to the pollen. So as bees are going from one flower to another, collecting nectar, and they collect this pollen, on the pollen sacs. And then that is kind of transferred from one plant to another. Am I correct about that? And that helps pollinate these different plants?
Right. And I think the honeybee, some pollinators, you know, go all over the place, but my understanding is a honeybee will stick with a certain variety, a certain plant.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're really efficient pollinators that way.
Yeah. Lawrence, great stuff. I appreciate that lesson in nature. And I was the one. I definitely misspoke. I said it was on their wings. So thanks for correcting that.
And one more thing that we probably don't have time to really talk about it, but it's the dance, the bee dance.
Mm-hmm.
Is one of the most amazing things, and we still probably are trying to figure it out, but a bee will come in into a hive and will do this dance. Say a worker bee will be flying around and find a fresh patch of nectar. It will come in into the hive and dance in it, and then the worker bees will go out and find it. And my understanding is a lot of times the bee that's dancing doesn't even go out with them. And somehow with that dance, they can figure out where to go to get the. It's just an amazing thing.
We did have Sandra who told us about the book called The Music of Bees, where a lot of that is discussed. So you might want to put that on your list. Thanks so much, Lawrence.
Well, very good.
Bye. All right. Take care. And on to Shelburne we go next, and let's talk to Ted. Ted, great to have you. What's going on?
Oh, thank you. Well, this is just a quick one, but it's an interesting set of words and concept. It's called Bee with two Bs, B-E-E. The Change,
and
you can Google, and it's an interesting business that puts pollinator plants underneath and around solar farms.
Yeah, they do great work, and I think they sell some of the honey that they harvest from that to help finance it.
Honeys and some other products and stuff. I just thought it's a good tie-in. Thanks very much.
A great one, yeah. BEE, The Change. And you can find it. I think it's BEE, The Change, BeTheChange.com. And you can find out about their work and the products they have. Thanks, Ted. That's another great recommendation. All right. Well, since we're in nature, let me read to you what we got yesterday from the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. They're saying that warm spring weather and melting snow will cause bears to come out of the winter dens in search of food earlier than normal. So they're recommending taking down bird feeders, keeping them stored until next December to avoid attracting bears. According to Jacqueline Como, who is the department's bear biologist, she says, although we typically recommend taking down bird feeders by April 1st, when that's what most people probably have circled on their calendar, they're asking Vermonters to take them down early this year. And here's why. They're already receiving bear reports as of March 7th, which is quite early. So encouraging Vermonters who experience a conflict with bears to submit a report through the Living with Black Bears webpage. The warmer temperatures predicted now will stimulate more bears to emerge from their den to seek any food source they can smell. So bird feeders are just one of the things that can attract hungry bears. Other sources of food that bears find appealing, garbage. Oh, yeah, they love that. Open dumpsters, backyard chickens, pet food, barbecue grills, campsites with accessible food and food waste. So not only do you want to get the bird feeders down early this year, but the Department of Fish and Wildlife also saying store garbage in bear-proof containers or structures. Trash cans alone are not enough. They say use electric fences to keep chickens and honeybees safe. We've been talking a lot about bees, and, of course, the bears love what the bees are producing there, that honey. So you can use electric fences to scare them off. Request a bear-proof dumpster from your waste hauler and feed your pets indoors. So you don't want to put kibble and dog food outside. That'll bring the bears right close to your house. And never feed bears deliberately or accidentally. And I don't know if you remember, gosh, it must be about a year ago, I had the author of A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear, and a really interesting book about town over in New Hampshire. And quite a few people did take it upon themselves in that town to feed the bears. And it is a bad situation you're creating. So do not, whether it be accidental or deliberately, feed bears. But if you can, and I know you want the birds as long as you can, but get the bird feeders down early this year. The bears are on the move because of the warmer temperatures. All right. Danny, hang it up. That'll be it for open phones this morning. Thanks to everyone who called. Great calls this morning. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll learn about another one of those really interesting businesses we have here in Vermont, Bia Diagnostics. And coming up today at 4, we've got the afternoon news service with Brady Farkas, followed by the Brady Farkas Show, and then jazz with George Thomas at 7 o'clock. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Vermont evokes images of beautiful scenery, snow-covered mountains, resorts full of skiers and riders, forests full of flavorful foliage, and farms presenting a picture of pastoral calm. But Vermont also has businesses that are interesting, innovative, and intelligent in what they do. I've been highlighting several of them on the show, and this morning I have another that we should all know about. It's called Bia Diagnostics. It's located in Colchester, and here to talk about what the company does is their CEO, Tom Grace. Tom, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
Good. Luke, our lab manager, is here also.
Hey, how are you, Rick?
Great. And what's your name?
Luke Emerson-Mason, Laboratory Director at Bia Diagnostics.
All right. Thanks, Luke. All right. So I'll do my best to guide the questions to the appropriate person, but if I get it wrong, you'll just point at the other, and one of you will jump in with the answer. And listeners, to ask Tom or Luke about Bia Diagnostics, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Tom, start us off with that 10,000-foot view of what Bia Diagnostics is.
Well, we're a food testing laboratory for companies, food manufacturers, institutions, et cetera, for quality control purposes and for research.
And
so primarily, again, for food, environmental, safety, quality control, and for research purposes. Yeah.
All right. And I believe your company description says food and nutraceutical. Luke, what does that mean, nutraceutical?
Well, nutraceutical can mean dietary supplements, you know, it can mean pharmaceutical in some cases. It can also mean a lot of times, you know, CBD products are becoming a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's primarily the gist of that.
All right. And Tom, is Bia the name of the company, B-I-A, pronounced Bia, is it short for something or what does it mean?
It's the Irish word for food. I was born in Dublin, Ireland.
Ah.
I immigrated here when I was about 5 years old, I figured I would acknowledge my heritage by naming it food diagnostic, using the Irish word for food, Bia. Bia also is the Bia Bureau in Ireland, is the FDA of Ireland. So I just figured it was a good name to call my company.
Oh, I love it.
And acknowledge my heritage.
Well, why and when did the company get started, Tom?
Well, that's a good story. I was working for several European companies who manufacture lab equipment, lab test kits for quality control, for food quality control, environmental safety, and human safety. And I was tasked by these companies to develop the North American market for these type of testing in laboratories and in food production facilities. And back in 1992, I believe, I was working for a German company called ArmBiopharm, and they made kits for all those things I just mentioned. But one of them was also gluten, which really most companies that produce gluten-free were not testing. So I went around to all four food manufacturers in the United States who claimed that their product was gluten-free and asked them if they'd be willing to test to make sure that they are gluten-free, but none of them wanted to do it then. Today, you know, I would say there are thousands upon thousands of companies today producing gluten-free products and do testing. And so back then, I saw there was a need for this type of testing. And in 2006, with my daughter, I decided to form Bia Diagnostics to service the food industry and environmental industry. And previous to that, the methods that were developed to detect these type of proteins, the allergens that might be found in food, were not up to speed. They were basically designed to detect unprocessed foods that, you know, pure grains, but products that laboratories are seen to do testing have seen food that's been extruded, heated, processed in some way. And that changes the protein conformation, how the protein is put together. And the antibodies that they use for detecting these proteins were not great at detecting these processed proteins. They were good at unprocessed, but not processed. So along with a partner out in the West Coast called ICL, they agreed to make some antibodies for us that were designed to detect the highly processed foods and also could detect unprocessed foods. And then we started developing our own assays using these antibodies for egg, for milk, for peanut, for coconut, for a whole variety of different types of allergens that the government has declared to be labeled on food products. And so we opened the lab in 2007, my daughter and I, and started building up our clientele. And today we have a brand new facility. Well, it's not new anymore. It's 5 years old here in Colchester. And we do anywhere between 50 and 250 samples a day for food allergens, but also we do hemp testing, cannabis testing, and a variety of other analytes, even GMO.
Wow. Luke, that must keep you pretty busy there in the lab. What type of companies engage BIA to test their products?
Yeah, primarily, you know, large food manufacturers, a lot of bigger companies from outside of Vermont, you know, from the biggest companies you would recognize to small local mom and pops. Anyone that's making label claims about being allergen-free, you know, that doesn't say may contain peanuts or tree nuts, you know, they want to confirm that their product is free from allergens. As some people may know, in, you know, 2008, I believe the Food Allergen Labeling and Consumer Protection Act went into effect, requiring companies to label what the U.S. refers to as the Big Eight allergens: wheat, tree nuts, soy, milk, egg, fish, crustacean. I might have missed one there, but yeah, so, you know, Tom certainly timed it really well, opening in 2007. I joined the company in 2010, and we've certainly seen a lot of growth since then.
Well, not just growth, Luke, but in those 12 years that you've been involved in the 15 of the company, how have the processes changed for detecting what you're looking for, the contaminants in these different food products?
Yeah, well, there's always, you know, research being done. There's always companies releasing new test kits, new technologies that we try and stay on top of. Certainly things have gotten more sophisticated. You know, companies have long, in their production facilities, have used rapid tests that are sort of like pregnancy tests, or as people might know now, COVID test strips, you know, to test for the allergens in their facilities. But you know, it's not as they're not designed as much for finished products. They're not as complex, so it's definitely good to have third-party labs, you know, that can run the accredited, more sophisticated test methods for the peace of mind.
So, yeah, we try to use accredited methods, usually through AOAC. It's an organization that helps to certify a test method and basically show that the method does what it says it does, so it can detect a variety of different, in a variety of different matrices, the analyte declaration. So, for example, peanut. You want to make sure that the test you're running can detect the peanut in, let's say, oil, or let's say a candy bar that's been extracted. fine mesh so that it breaks everything up, but you want to make sure that you can be able to detect that protein in that environment. So that organization puts these test kits through a certain amount of rigorous oversight, making sure that it can do all those things. And if you succeed, it might take years and a lot of money to do all this certification by the kit company, but then you can have a label on your kit saying that it's AOAC approved.
Tom, you mentioned one thing that's kind of growing, no pun intended, but in importance and in the amount of work you're doing for this is hemp products. So what would you be testing hemp products for?
We were looking at cannabinoids. Those are the compounds that are found in hemp, CBD, CBG, THCA, et cetera. Usually non-hallucinogenic type compounds have healing characteristics, apparently. We've also been looking at certain other aspects of hemp, such as the terpenes, that is the things that give it flavor or taste. And we also, for safety purposes, we test for residual solvents, which might mean, different types of alcohols or maybe acetone that might have been extracted or used for extracting purposes. We also can test for heavy metals that can be toxic. Also, pesticides and mycotoxins. Mycotoxins are compounds that are found or produced by yeast and mold. In certain circumstances, they are extremely carcinogenic, immunogenic, mutagenic compounds. So we can test for those as well and do also looking for certain types of microbiological bacteria that could be contaminant in the product.
Luke, you said you're testing several hundred of these a day, not just hemp, but for other products. So how long does it typically take to do the testing that's required by BIA?
Well, it depends if you're testing one sample alone or maybe 50 samples at a time and, what the samples are. Obviously, if they're a dry flower, you have to grind up, homogenize the sample, weigh it out and extract it and then run it in the instrument, it might take certainly a full day, and then we have to, analyze the data and report that out to the customer.
Which takes another half a day. But it also depends upon what assays you're running, really. Some take longer than others. For example, the ELISA methods, which is basically what we use for the allergen detection, which uses an antibody to find and detect the antigen or the protein that we're looking for. Those can be run in a few hours, and you can batch them so that you can do the 50 samples or 100 samples at a time. As opposed to looking at the hemp, which takes a lot more sample prep, possible process of grinding it and processing it and extracting it and then put in a format that the instruments can detect it, is very time-consuming and does take an entire day plus to do.
Now, Luke, one thing I saw that your company does is you test for food authenticity and food fraud. What exactly would that be?
Sure. So for that, we use PCR, polymerase chain reaction, where we, test for specific DNA fragments. A lot of times, it would be like maybe horse contamination in beef or, certain species of fish, that sort of thing. People might claim a certain provenance of honey or olive oil that's not true. That's all done with, PCR testing the same way they test for COVID currently, but, we're looking obviously for different DNA fragments.
Tom, the companies you work for, you perform tests for, are they primarily from Vermont, from the U.S.? Where are your clients from?
Well, I'm in California, throughout the entire country, plus Canada, Mexico. We have samples coming in from Pakistan, South America, South Africa. We've had samples from them. So it's U.S. and Canada, but, they can come from anywhere. I want to go back to one more thing, is that we do manufacture some test kits for the food industry for 3M. When I first started BIA, we started making our own assays, and eventually customers came to us and asked us if they could make, we could make a rapid, like a pregnancy test for them so that they could test their own products on the line or equipment or whatever. So we decided to start building those things and putting them together, again, with our partner in the West Coast who had developed the antibodies. And then we started building up that business until about 5 years ago when 3M came to us and asked us if we'd be willing to sell to them, and they gave us an offer and became hard to refuse. So now we still make those kits. We sell them to 3M, and they distribute them worldwide, right? So these companies from, you know, largest companies in the world to the smallest little companies that need to test their equipment or test their products, they would use this device to do that. And it, what's nice about it is that it doesn't take much education to run it. It's very simple. It takes 10 minutes to run these type of methods. Again, you're using antibodies that detect specific proteins, and we conjugate or we add a compound to it so that we can visualize when the sample binds to the strip, if it contains, let's say, peanut or egg or milk.
Yeah.
And so, again, we sell those to 3M, and they sell them worldwide.
Luke, something like food allergen testing has to be incredibly precise. So what type of margin for error is there with that type of testing?
You know, we're testing at very low levels, well below the etiological level that most people would react to. So there's a bit of a safety factor built in there, you know, required by regulation. But, you know, if we're testing down at, you know, 2 to 5 parts per million, which is like a needle in a haystack, you know, it's generally accepted that there's a 20% margin for error. But again, then your difference, you know, is still, it's still a very small number either way.
Gotcha. Tom, how large a company is Bia?
Well, we have 15 employees. We have several interns come through here. And so at any given time, there's anywhere between 15 to 17, 18 people who work here.
And for employees, what kind of an educational, vocational background are you looking for?
Well, we ask that either a lot of experience or at least a college degree, and prefer a master's if possible. We have all of that here. We have people with PhDs, people with master's, and people who are who just graduated the university. So usually a science background is very helpful, and somebody who is an independent thinker and a critical thinker. That's what we look for, people who are able to think critically about what they're doing as they do these very important assays. Because if we do make a mistake, it could kill somebody.
Yeah.
If somebody, you know, we say it's safe for that company to sell their product and it does contain the analyte that we were trying to detect and we didn't detect it, then there's a problem for not only the company, but for our company, but most importantly, the consumer, the person who might die from ingesting that allergen that they're allergic to.
Tom, how would you describe the company culture there at Bia?
Well, it's very much a family, I think. We have twice a year, we usually do an internship sort of where we go out and play golf, or we will go to what do you call those rooms?
Escape rooms, right?
But we have very great, good benefits here. There's no out of pocket for any sort of medical insurance. There's no, you know, nothing for pharmaceutical if you need, you know, something for your health. There's no charge for that because we pay for all of that. We start off with a 5-week vacation that's how people start off. We also have between Christmas and New Year is off. The whole company is closed down at that time. We might do some internal maintenance, but we just stop everything for that period. And we have very good salaries. You know, we give, and the benefits at the end of the year, there's profit sharing as well.
And am I right, you also have an office dog?
Well, we don't have an office dog per se, but I have a, we have people who come in with their dogs, and that's great. We love it.
That is fantastic. We got about 30 seconds. Luke, what kind of individual would you say would enjoy working at BIA?
You know, definitely a team player, but someone, you know, who's motivated and likes autonomy. And like Tom said, a critical thinker, but, you know, certainly the most important thing here is that we work as a team to get, you know, the large amount of work we do with a relatively small number of people.
That's Luke Emerson Mason, the laboratory director at BIA, and also talking to Tom Grace, CEO of BIA Diagnostics in Colchester. And listeners, to learn more about their work, you can visit BIA, that's BIA, BIADiagnostics.com. Tom and Luke, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it.
Enjoyed it.
All right, take care.
Have a good day.
You too.
Thanks.
That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. Feel free to suggest topics or guests by emailing vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. And you can listen to past episodes at wdevradio.com. The podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. That'll be followed by the governor's COVID-19 response news conference right after CBS News. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we visit the Northfield Farmers Market. We discuss EVs in the winter, and we meet poet Matthew Olsman.